But this Len Kaczynski and the private investigator that he had, Michael O'Kelly, you can't come away with this with any other conclusion than that they were working with the prosecution because they believed the initial confession story, and they were trying to keep him straitjacketed into that story. And subsequently, again, he tried to appeal for that lawyer to be off the case, and it didn't happen initially, but eventually he ended up getting new representation at trial. Are we clear on this, on Brandon?
I'm not finding anything that said he testified. So.
Okay. All right. Maybe I'm remembering that wrong, but that's...
It was the little girl, that Kayla, that they picked apart.
That's right. They picked her apart, but it was a matter of, with him, his inability to... Well, actually, no, there was, because remember he was saying, I got it in a book, or am I thinking of his subsequent testimony?
He said that in the video, that he got it in a book.
Okay, all right, so they played that then. Okay, they played that part of, I got it in a book, and okay, that's what I was thinking of instead of his testimony. But yeah, so he was not able to give any kind of a more coherent thing. I mean, if it was like any of the rest of us, and that had happened to us, now again, I guess it's a catch-22 because the kid is so dim in the first place, but I mean, wouldn't you think or hope that somebody would at least have the wherewithal to be like, I said that because that's the path you were leading me down. You put that in my head. You would think that he would be able to say that much at least. But, you know, ultimately, his trial was what it was. I think it was a fait accompli after they got Stephen Avery, and that's why, like I said, I wanted to kind of get to that. And was there anything else about his trial that kind of made you think of anything?
Because it's not really. The only thing is, you know, with that Len Kaczynski, he didn't really have a fair fight from the beginning. That's part of what they're still pushing for. They're still trying on his appeals.
Right.
Even the attorney he ended up with said, I had nothing to work with because, you know, they pushed him as guilty.
Right.
So, and it turns out one of the things that bothered me on that was that investigator of Kaczynski's,
Michael O'Kelly,
later on, yes, said he was related to Halbach.
That's right. That's right. So a clear conflict of interest. And it was a thing where, and again, there's the reasoning that you give for something like this where you're kind of letting somebody off the hook morally and you just concede that it's the worst kind of incompetence, or you look at this in a way, as a lot of people are, of where these people were crooked or in cahoots with law enforcement in a small town. And a lot of people, I think the people who are unfortunately giving death threats to Len Kaczynski right now as he is battling for his life, which, you know, seems to me to be overkill.
Death threats aren't right.
No, not you know, in any circumstance. And the guy's battling for his life with cancer. You know, I would like to think we could let things go at that point. But it's a thing where, you know, the worst case scenario morally is that, yeah, they were in cahoots with law enforcement. But the story that they're giving, in which case, you say, if you believe their story, it's just that they're incompetent, is, oh, we believe the initial confession. And again, you know, if you're looking for what's best for your client, how could, hey, settle for the best deal you can get on a guilty plea, how could that be a better way of approaching it than the kid is saying, I'm innocent, I've been railroaded, my initial confession isn't worth the paper it was written on?
You have to defend your client. Now, yeah. I've talked to attorneys. This has been in the past. I've had issues myself.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you admit guilt, your attorney has to defend you in the best way he can.
That's right.
He's your attorney. He's not on his own. He's not doing his own thing. He's your attorney. He's there to defend you.
Right.
And if you say that was BS, that whole video was BS, then he has to believe that whole video was BS.
Yeah, and he didn't. And that's the thing that a lot of people are looking at and just kind of shaking their heads. You go back to the trial of Stephen Avery, which again happened before the Dassey trial, but again, the Dassey one, like, we could all see what direction that was going. The real kind of drama, if any, was in the Stephen Avery trial and how that ended up going. So, although I do have to say the one thing about the Brandon Dassey trial, in terms of you know, how the internet is kind of looking at it now and kind of rediscovering this again, I'm dumbfounded that this wasn't a huge national case at the time. That's been one of the things surprising to me. Now, Nancy Grace covered this like sparingly at the time, and there was a little bit of brief national attention here or there as it was happening. But something like this is, I mean, that's what makes this so out of the ordinary. A guy that served 18 years for something he didn't do, and he's back on the hook for a murder charge. You would have thought this would have been, you know, totally in the spotlight. And I think the way the world has changed, and especially with social media and everything, that I think this would be a huge case today, regardless of where it happened. If the same thing had happened today and there'd been no precedent for this, that it would be a huge national case. But one of the things that I've seen pop up on the internet is everybody's been out there making their memes and their GIFs about what happened and everything. And there's an eye-rolling GIF of a reporter in this, where Mike Halbach, Teresa Halbach's brother.
I do not like that guy.
Who, and a lot of people have that thought. He was the family spokesman, essentially. And there's a GIF of this reporter rolling her eyes at him because he's asked about after Brendan Dassey testified. Or actually, no, I think this was from when he testified on the stand. I think this was an actual thing here. Okay, I think it was because he's saying that I don't like that he lied. That's it. I think this was on the stand, Anthony, because he said, I'm disappointed at what he said. I'm disappointed that he didn't stick with his story. And somebody asked him, did you watch the entire four-hour confession? Do you even know what he had said previously? And Mike said, no, I didn't. And then this reporter just kind of rolls her eyes at him. That's kind of consistent with the whole thing. For those of us that look at this, my feelings towards him aren't as, not quite as strong as yours in the sense of, again, you know, we would never want to be in the spot that he's in. His sister was murdered, whatever. But I think both of us have the basic kind of sense going into something like this. In terms of trusting law enforcement and everything like that. If you know that these same people in law enforcement, this same community, sent him up for 18 years for something he didn't do, while the real rapist, Gregory Allen, was out there. And, oh, by the way, raped a few other people in that span as well. He got picked up subsequently for crimes committed after the 1985 rape. You know, is there any part of you that would be want to be saying to the police people and the sheriff's department, are you sure? Are you sure? Because we've heard this before about this guy. Are you sure? But he was just lapping up everything they were saying. And the family clearly was believing everything they were saying. And that's some of the way that he was, you know, carrying himself is kind of consistent with, and you get this sort of more so in certain parts of the country. Wisconsin, of course, right next to Minnesota. The show Fargo and the movie also, the entire Fargo franchise has kind of, you know, spotlighted this whole thing of Minnesota nice and, you know, the people up there, and everybody feels compelled to try to be nice even when they don't feel like it. And I think that kind of bleeds over into Wisconsin a little bit too. And sometimes what you get with that is passive aggressiveness. And I don't know about you, but a lot of his stuff seemed passive aggressive towards him. Not even the thing of like, I hate this guy, he murdered my sister, I hope he burns. I think we could understand that a lot more so than these shots that he's taking. He's just kind of like, at one point during the trial, he says, oh, you know, our family, you know, we love law enforcement. The other side, not so much, right. I guess.
Right.
And it's that kind of stuff. I mean, like, you talk about the way that seeing him made you feel. What were you, describe it for me. What were some of the things you were thinking when he would get up there and give his little shots toward the one side or whatever?
I can't in my life pretend to imagine what he's going through.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I do have siblings that have passed. I wasn't alive when they passed, so I can't answer how he feels.
Right.
The only thing I would say is if it were my family, mm-hmm. and I could tell you this beyond a shadow of a doubt, I would want answers.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't jump straight up and start screaming, oh, this guy's a liar. You can't trust anything he says. You can't say this. You can't know this. You can't do this. This guy's a liar. He seemingly has an answer for everything they put to him.
Yeah.
And that's an issue for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because he hadn't even started in court when he said, well, if he wants to sit there and lie about things.
Mm-hmm.
How do you know he's lying about things?
Yeah.
Have you heard the evidence? You know, mm-hmm. he says he saw the evidence. I've seen things later on that says only thing he knows is Ken Kratz. Before the trial, Ken Kratz told him there was enough evidence to convict this guy.
Right.
If that were me, I'd want to see. I'd want to know. I'd want to sit through court.
Right.
This guy didn't seem to want to do that.
Right.
Which leads me to believe other things. And we're not quite there yet to where I can say what it leads me to believe. But it leads me to quite kind of believe, you know, if you got a guy who spent 18 years in jail, it's real easy to set him up.
Yeah. And that's the thing here, too, that, again, best case scenario, the kid was just very kind of incurious, didn't think to look into stuff further than he did. Worst case scenario, a little bit kind of obstinate. Again, maybe that's not the worst case scenario as far as, again, a lot of the people out there on Reddit right now, there are some people that are constructively trying to look into things. And it's funny because the side, initially it's the side that believed that Stephen Avery was guilty that aggravated me more when I was online, both on Reddit, at AV Club, where they've been discussing the show, all these condescending people. Oh, all you Netflix detectives who passed the Netflix bar exam. So great that are Netflix lawyers, I should say. Oh, good that you amateur lawyers out there know how to pick stuff apart. And initially, I thought those douches were more aggravating than anybody else. But I'll tell you what, in some of the people who are so staunchly Stephen Avery and who take personally everything that is against the guy, who are so, I don't know how anybody can watch this and be 100% convinced that he's innocent. Now, I'll tell you, you and I are 100% convinced that he and his nephew deserve new trials.
Right.
I hope everybody can at least agree on that, whether you watch this.
I do not know whether he did it. I cannot tell you whether he did it or not. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm so stumped beyond anything.
Yeah.
But that's what our criminal justice system is all about, or supposed to be about.
Yep.
If you can't say without a reasonable doubt that he did it, then he's innocent.
Yeah.
And I don't think that the state of Wisconsin did their fair burden to show that he did this.
I agree. And there's another thing, too. And this is a thing where, again, there's framing your case in court, and there's outright demagoguery and appealing deliberately to ignorance. And Ken Kratz said something in the closing arguments here about that reasonable doubt is for innocent people, which is the biggest load of crap I've ever. Reasonable doubt is for anybody that gets tried, and you are presumed innocent until you're proven guilty. That applies to everybody. And for him to say, again, that Stephen Avery doesn't deserve the benefit of the doubt. Now, on the one hand, it's a thing where, you know, we're not going to talk about his previous case. That has no bearing on this. Ken Kratz didn't want that to be something the jurors thought about because it would make Stephen Avery more sympathetic because he spent 18 years away for something he didn't do. But he seemed to be wanting to take advantage of whatever presumption you might have in your head that he was away for 18 years, you know, that his crimes have escalated in seriousness here with murder. You know, I don't think he was just referring to the burglary and to the dead cat and to whatever harassment stuff before that. He clearly wanted you to think about the rape, which didn't happen as far as being committed by Stephen Avery. So Ken Kratz, again, trying to have it both ways as far as what he's trying to plant into people's heads. But, again, it's some of the people on Reddit, I think, unfortunately, that have given the death threats to Len Kaczynski. They've kind of lashed out at some of the other folks here. The Jody Stankowski thing, too, Stephen's ex-fiancée, who, this is an interesting thing. I wanted to talk about this with you a little bit because she now is, again, she was away at the time. And so she doesn't know for sure whether he did this or not. She talked to him on the day of the murder. There are recordings of it, or presumed day of the murder. I mean, if we assume that Teresa was killed the same day, she talked to him, and because all jailhouse recordings and whatnot are recorded, and he did. This would have been right at the time when he had either murdered her or was about to finish it or whatever, and he sounded normal in that conversation. But again, people that are that sick in the head, you know, I think they probably don't have a hard time making themselves sound like nothing's going on because they are that psychotic. So I don't know that it proves anything one way or another. But you came across some stuff today where Dean Strang was talking about her state of mind at the time. She was very supportive of him at the time, and now she's recanting her story years later. I think he did it. He was abusive to me at the time. I believe he's the kind of monster who could do this. I don't know about you. I got the sense in watching the thing of where She's talking to him on the phone. He's in jail. And it seemed to me like she's straining to believe him. And, like, he's wanting her to be more supportive and more whatever. And she's kind of like, okay. And, like, it made me uncomfortable watching it because I thought to myself, wow, she's either struggling with her doubts or she may think he did it. What's your sense of what her state of mind was?
There were times where they pulled her in. And they had a couple of videos where they showed you that she was perfectly fine. He didn't do it. No, he didn't do it. No, he didn't do it. She was on there a number of times. No, he didn't do it.
Okay.
You know, he sounded fine. I believe her on that. When she came back and recanted her story, that's where I don't believe her. Because there's too many things in that that just sound so iffy. And I know I'm no detective. I'm no lawyer. But from personal situations that I've been in and comments she has made, she made a comment about she could have been there that night.
Right.
If he'd have picked her up.
Right.
She was in jail for a DUI.
Right.
Why would they let you out to go to a DUI class?
Yeah. Well, that's a good question.
Why would they let you out to go to a DUI class when...
That's a very good question. That's a very good question. I don't know why that would be an issue there. I don't know why that would be something that would be, introduced into the bloodstream of this case. Because I think in looking at it here, my point of view is just a little bit different in the sense that I never really saw her as being ride and die at the time of the thing here, of that she was necessarily always the most supportive and always the most believing. So that's what's interesting. You can kind of view that different ways. But this is another thing here too. When we go to Reddit, and the people online who are some of the vigilantism that's going on, the whole presumption, the name calling, oh, this white trash alky bitch, how dare she? It's just like, you don't know, man. You don't, I mean, it's as with anything, it all depends on the facts of the case. Okay. I mean, it's pretty heinous if she really doesn't believe that. It's pretty heinous if he never beat her, if he treated her well, and if she is making this up for attention. That's pretty heinous.
It is. It is pretty heinous, but maybe he did, maybe he didn't.
Sure.
But she didn't, and I'm sure people are gonna call me on this. I've seen abusive situations.
Okay.
I've been moving women out in the middle of the night with friends of mine and stuff just to make them gone. It takes a lot more than what she said and what she did.
Okay.
To get an abusive woman to leave a situation. I know she was told legally. Women do still try to push back. They do still try to come back because it's a controlling thing.
Right.
And she didn't seem to show any of those. Plus, not only that, there were points in time where they showed her and him, and she had to have had some really good makeup if she was getting beat the way she says she was.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. And see, you know some things about this whole dynamic that I don't. It's a thing where, in looking at it, you know, her perspective on this, as far as what she would think of him as a character witness, that's the only thing I can think that the prosecution would be squeezing her on, right? Because she was away when this happened.
Right.
What else could it be? Would it just be a thing of like, he beat me, he's a bad guy, he whatever, you should believe he could do this because he's a bad guy? Like, that part of it, like, she has no direct connection to the case here. That struck me as being weird.
No, but coming back out, it's all a matter of how many people have taken advantage of this show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how many people have watched this show? I mean, calling us out, we're even doing a podcast because so many people have watched this show.
That's right.
This is her chance to get her face out there, to get her name out there, to be somebody.
It is.
And if she just came out and said, oh, no, he didn't do it, well, that's the same thing as in the documentary. She's not going to get any hits or views on that. But if you come out with something shocking and say, oh, he was a monster and he abused me and he beat me, hey, guess what? That's the biggest thing since sliced bread.
Well, exactly. You know, and something that you and I have talked about as well here and laughed about a good amount as far as the people jumping on the bandwagon now. There is this huge phenomenon of hipsters driving up to the salvage yard in Wisconsin, sneaking onto the property and taking selfies of themselves.
Let's do it.
In front of there, yeah.
I want to go buy a part from Avery Salvage.
Yeah, you would think they'd be doing better business right now, if nothing else. You know, but the cast of characters in this thing, the one thing also, too, I don't think this guy necessarily played much of a role in the trial of Stephen Avery, but we'd be remiss if we didn't leave him out. This Gene Kusha, I believe, was the name. K-U-C-H-E. Yeah, I don't know the pronunciation. That's the guy that rose from being sketch artist to being higher up in the department at the time. He did the initial sketch of Stephen Avery. He was getting deposed in 2005, and he was basically like trolling the lawyer of like, well, you say he didn't do it. You say that he's out because he didn't do it. And they're like, he got released because there was new evidence, new DNA evidence.
Right, right.
And finally the lawyer's like, so you're telling me you think your sketch is more scientific than the DNA evidence?
You say.
Yeah. You say that. Yeah. just watching this obstinate guy trolling them in a sick way was kind of funny. But you look at the whole thing here, too. I talked about this before in terms of Ken Kratz being a guy who didn't show an ounce of human empathy here in this matter, in terms of how this was put out there. And, again, the way that he conducted this as though we're supposed to believe that Stephen Avery also committed the rape previously. Not that he would ever say that, but he seemed to be trying to, you know, capitalize on the fact that the guy had been away for 18 years to get you to think it's this pattern of behavior, he's a bad guy, etc. Talk about it with the Halbach family also, too. I think you and I might have been looking for a little bit more in terms of them being kind of open to look at other things here. I have to say as well, when I'm talking about people where I fault their point of view and looking at this thing, I got to circle this thing back around to the Avery family as well, because and from the minute that and so much of this, again, and I have to say this, you know, in terms of whether it be what we saw of Mike Halbach or these other people, whatever, you have what I think the documentarians have even admitted is a fairly pro-defense point of view on this. I'm not going to say militantly pro-defense like Ken Kratz would say, and he's been out there beating the drum recently. This is just propaganda from the defense team. Ken Kratz, among other things, is PO'd at the fact that they mentioned 3 years after this case, he got thrown out of his job there, and I think probably damn near disbarred for sexting some woman who'd been beaten, and he was covering that case, and he was sexting her, and he was, you know, coming on to her, you know, and sexually harassing her, and ended up, he blames it on a prescription drug issue that he had at the time here. For what is clearly a moral failing that he himself would never allow Stephen Avery. I can guarantee you that one. But it turns out that, again, it's a point of view that is geared pretty well towards the defense. I would not go so far as to call it propaganda, but it's pro-defense. It's pro-Stephen Avery.
Okay, I want to say this about Ken Kratz.
What?
I read this the other day, and I was saving this just for you.
Okay.
It came out, the source is actually TMZ.
Okay.
And it came out on the 4th.
Okay.
Okay. They actually interviewed Ken Kratz on, on TMZ, and they asked him about the blood from the car.
Okay.
And he said he does not totally believe that the blood from the car didn't come from that vial.
That's it.
And he thinks that if they can prove that,
yeah,
then Stephen should be granted a new trial.
There you go. Some of the evidence that was found is that Stephen Avery's blood was found in there. He was saying, hey, look, you guys got blood samples of me from the rape trial that happened previously. So they had his blood that they could have gone in there. Now, there's some kind of preservative or something that's in the blood, and there was not testing for it that was really in effect at the time of the murder case. The FBI steps up and says, well, we'll do a pilot program for you. So the FBI tests it and reports back and says, no, that was really Stephen Avery's blood in there. It wasn't taken from that vial because we couldn't find any of that preservative or ingredient or chemical or whatever the hell it was in there. They got an independent expert, the defense did, to challenge it and say that, no, that wasn't you know, necessarily the case.
They said it wouldn't be in every drop.
Yes, they did. They did say that. So that's what's interesting. And when we talk about planted evidence as well, the Nancy Graces of the world, Ken Kratzes right now, will tell you that Stephen Avery's sweat DNA was found underneath the latch of the RAV4. Ultimately, while there is DNA that can be transmitted via sweat, I don't think there's not necessarily a thing, and this has come out, as sweat DNA. It's just DNA that can be transmitted that way. It's just basically off your skin like anything else. And the person that was handling some of Stephen Avery's stuff was also handling the RAV4, should have changed their gloves, didn't, and could have spread it from their gloves to the hood latch of the RAV4. But so my point about this is that, again, you know, on Ken Kratz, his point of view, you know, there's stuff that we find not to like about that. There's stuff that we find not to like about Mike Halbach and his point of view and how he expresses it in this. This is not as popular a point of view when I say this, but the family. I think the family in terms of, and I understand the whole thing. I understand you've lost a member of your family for 18 years and you're thinking, here we go again. Should that be the only thing you're ever saying publicly? Because from the beginning, it was a thing of like Stephen Avery of, it's like, you know, oh my God, they're coming to get me, they're whatever. It's like, it's not even that there's a dead girl involved in it. When she was still missing, there was a thing where he was asked about it, and he said, oh, that family's got to be going through hell. But if for no other reason than it's not a smart thing in terms of public sympathy, which does play into this, because, again, we talked before, the jury pool was tainted against him by the prosecution, but I think the family didn't even put up a fight. How many times has the family said, you know, Teresa Halbach and the family, that's an awful thing. We got to get the real killer of this case, whatever. No, instead, to this day, his mom is out there reopening the wounds. I think Teresa Halbach might have faked her murder. She might have been in on this. I mean, the family itself, you know, if they showed even the slightest amount of empathy, and again, and I don't remember the specifics of what was said, but Stephen's sister Barb, and part of it is that it was hard to decipher the yelling. After Barb's son, Brandon Dassey, was convicted, Barb was yelling something about the Halbach family and they're part of this too, and the Avery family making it an us versus them against the Halbach family. First of all, that's not smart. You're not going to win that fight. They're a murder victim. Second of all, that's evidence of a warped perspective. Do you know what I mean? I mean, it's right. A bad thing. It's like, how do you let feeling sorry for yourself, feeling sorry for him, whatever, become the only point of view you're putting out there? Talk about that. I mean, do you agree with me at all on that?
I agree, but she didn't make any fans if she did. I've tried to go back and listen. She didn't make any fans if she screamed something out. The Averys, the big thing that bothers me is they've really never shown any empathy for the family.
Yes.
Of the Halbachs. You know, you got to feel empathy for them. They lost a loved one.
Yes.
You know, she was 25 years old. There's no right a 25-year-old should ever leave this earth for
right.
any reason. But I don't understand turning it into this and us for them versus them.
Yeah. It's not a winner, you know, as well as, like you said, you know, empathy is what makes you a human being. It's what makes you somebody that we can identify with and say, yeah, you know, you people are people that are suffering and injustice potentially. And they seemingly are, at least with Brandon. I mean, there are a lot more people that are convinced that Brandon had little to nothing to do with this or that he was forced to do whatever he did anyways. And the fact that Brandon has served, as we're recording this, 10 years, there's a real good case to be made. The worst thing, whatever the worst thing is that he did, in that it was likely under extreme duress from his uncle, you could probably say, hey, time served.
Time served. Goodbye.
Yeah, right. Yeah, goodbye. There's your 10 years. Instead, he's not eligible to be let out until 2048. But you look at the family, and to kind of bring this full circle here, after the conviction comes down, which, you know, seems inevitable as we're going through the trial here, I talked before about the sketchy nature of Charles Avery, Earl Avery, whether it be the convictions constantly being charged with, whether it be harassment, rape, whatever. Neither of those two guys is an angel, to be sure. You've also got Scott Tadich and Bobby Dassey. Scott Tadich, the either boyfriend or fiance at the time of Brendan Dassey's mother, Barb, subsequently got married to her. And by the way, and I've seen this pointed out online too, spouses cannot testify against one another. Right. So did that have anything to do with them getting married? Who knows? I don't think Barb would have anything to do with the guy if she thought that he was part of framing her son. But
he didn't have any alibis. The alibi was him and Bobby. That was it.
Yeah. Yeah, him and Bobby, Brandon's brother, they were both vouching for each other, and it was proved demonstrably false by the bus driver, because weren't they saying 3:30?
They were saying Bobby said he saw Scott at 3:15.
Yeah.
And the bus driver said, well, I didn't drop him off till between 3:30 and 3:40.
That's right.
So they turned this around.
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden they just made their own alibis, which is them.
Yeah.
A little bit sketchy.
But that's the whole thing of, officially, according to police at the outset, there was just Stephen Avery to hone in on. Right. The fact that the brothers were there, and this is where I go back to what I said earlier about, let's say that Stephen Avery did have a thing for Teresa Halbach. Let's say that this had happened. That doesn't point 100% towards his guilt in the way that you might think.
Right. She was a pretty girl. Maybe he did just like her.
Well, here's the thing.
That happens.
Well, it's possible. But it's possible. But Charles and Earl, because, again, the whole thing of, you know, that there was some potential jealousy over this large settlement that he was about to receive, petty jealousies in the family, old grudges, what have you. Not liking the fact that their brother had become a public hero after getting, you know, released, you know, from jail for something he didn't do. If they know he's got a thing for this girl, just looking at it, again, I don't want to say anything to get myself sued, but that's something that could point towards them.
Easy.
Yeah, in the sense of, hey, everybody's going to find out afterwards he had a thing for this girl. Everything's going to point towards him. It goes back to also, too, why wasn't her car crushed in the first place? There was a car crusher on site. There are some things the prosecution wants you to believe that he's an evil genius, albeit with an IQ of 70. And there are some things where it's just like, wait a minute here. If he killed her, why would he have been so stupid as to do that? Why would he have been so stupid as to have done this when the settlement was about to come down, or judgment against the county with all the money involved? And that's where Jody's thing kind of gets to this in terms of potentially connecting the dots of, he thought that he was a monster who thought he could act with impunity. I'm bulletproof.
Right.
They put me away for something I couldn't do, whatever. So that's where her thing gives plausibility to a scenario here. But as far as if you're looking at alternate scenarios, you look at the Avery brothers, you look at Tadich and Bobby Dassey, and the fact that neither one of those guys could provide any kind of, their stories were false. The stories that they were using were false, and that the police never looked in their direction. And, again, it doesn't make up for the fact that there's people on Reddit that are, you know, trying to, you know, beat the drum for them to go to jail right now, tomorrow, for having murdered her when they haven't even been tried for it yet. People who've been pointing the finger at guilt at Mike Halbach. Oh, maybe he murdered his sister. You know, the ex-boyfriend and the roommate, they were kind of sketchy. Well, the camera crews kind of made them look sketchy, and not to say that they weren't, but, right. I mean, there's people that are going so far with this stuff right now.
Well, here's the thing. Even by his own words, by his own words, he makes himself look sketchy.
Yes.
When he says, oh, I saw her that day.
Yeah.
Was it morning, noon, or night? I don't know. How
That's
do you
true.
Not know? We're recording this.
Yes.
2 months from now, if I ask you, was it morning, noon, or night? Was it light out?
Yeah.
When we recorded this, you're going to be able to say, yeah, it was light out.
That's right.
He doesn't know. He doesn't know whether it was morning, noon, or night.
Sure.
Also, their first call wasn't to her parents. Their first call wasn't to the police.
Right.
It was going on her Singular wireless account to make things up.
That's right. That's right, and trying to get through to her voicemail so that they could find out, you know, what's going on. Again, from their public point of view, to try to find out what happened to her. But again, we're just taking their word for that. So that's the thing. There's a lot of scenarios that are being put out there. The one that I think is just completely reprehensible to be putting out there, this goes back to what Mama Avery was saying before about she faked her own death. How do we know she's even dead? And then, you know, the reporters that she said that to was like, there is DNA evidence with her burned, charred bones that it's her.
You can make that up.
You know, yeah. How do we know? You know, this kind of crap. The other thing, too, of people putting out the theory that she committed suicide, and that, because there is the whole thing here, too. Look, the cops, I don't think the cops are in cahoots with whoever killed her. I think the cops, again, I believe firmly there was some dirty stuff going on. I think they were opportunistic in this. It doesn't mean that I don't think he's innocent. He may have done this, and the cops may have piled on just to make sure that he got convicted. But the alternate scenarios of, if you believe Charles or Earl Avery, with their own demonstrable shady history towards women, if you believe that they killed her, or this Scott Tadich, who was all too happy to have Stephen Avery go to jail and acted like it was the greatest thing ever, if you believe these things, that's one thing. But if you to put it out there that, you know, again, Mama Avery's a lunatic. She faked her own murder. But the thing of it, like, that she committed suicide, how can anybody be putting that out there at this point in time? That's, like, the family does not, you know, deserve something like that.
It's disturbing.
Yes.
It really is.
Yeah.
But you don't know the inner workings of somebody.
Right.
And you can't discount, you really can't discount that. And, you know, I know that sounds harsh.
It's,
I know,
somewhere, that sounds, it is somewhere horrible on the spectrum of possibilities, but I think it's so far down the spectrum that we shouldn't even be putting that out there.
Right. I agree. But I think it was worth somebody's time to put out there.
It's, you know, if you're looking at alternate scenarios again, but I mean, I just...
You have to look at every option. You can't, as far-fetched as it seems, you have to look at every angle. You have to look at everything. I do believe that the Manitowoc police thought, oh, hey, here's Stephen Avery. He's a suspect in this.
Right.
You know, hey, let's do whatever we can to push this along.
Right.
I don't think they did it on purpose. I don't think there was any intent here. I do think once his name came on the list that they made it a little more, holding up air quotes doesn't work on a podcast, that they were a little more into it to want to make sure that he got it.
Well, and here's the thing, too. The key evidence alone, the key that magically appeared in his bedroom with, I think it was Lenk that had been in there, who had an axe to grind legally, that in and of itself makes me say the case is tainted. And that law enforcement, whether it's to a small degree or a medium degree or even a large degree, had their thumb on the scale here. And if it's to any degree, he needs a new trial. And that's where I'm 100% on he needs a new trial. I'm 100% Brandon Dassey needs a new trial.
He needs a new trial for so many reasons.
Yes, he does. And the thing of it is, too, the fear that's out there. Now again, there's a thing where, you know, in the Ken Kratzes of the world, he's there, you know, clutching his pearls like, oh, putting the family through this again, whatever. You know, well, here's the thing, too. This entire thing, and he's bemoaning this Netflix project, as are so many, for allegedly doing that. But to anybody that was paying attention to this all the while, which we weren't, we just became aware of this case just like 99% of the rest of the universe. To anybody that was paying attention to the case, they knew from looking at this, there's a chance to whatever degree that the real murderer got away and that justice hasn't been delivered to this family.
I have a cousin who lives up in that area.
Yeah.
Posted on my Facebook, which you read,
yes,
believes that to be the case.
Yes. And that's a thing where, at the end of the day, I think what is owed most of all is justice to that family. Whether it's Stephen Avery, whether it's being able to extinguish any doubt that he did it and he's where he belongs, or to get the real killer. The family deserves to have the real killer prosecuted, and that should be the foremost thought here. And that's where, like I said, my problem right now with a lot of the people online is that they have an agenda. They've made up their minds. I think if you're any kind of a reasonable person, you can be goosed in one direction or another. But, I mean, I think to have certainty, you know, off of 10 hours of watching something and then whatever other research you've done on your own. By the way, but before we get to the absolute full circle and wrapping this up, let's get back to the jury. You mentioned this before.
I've been
you teased
for
it.
That.
Yeah, yeah. That's, let's get to that.
Okay, the jury kind of got me.
Uh-huh.
Because if you notice at the end of the episode, Dean Strang walked into the house, mm-hmm, and he said, seven out of the jurors,
yeah,
voted not guilty on first try.
Yes.
Okay. What happens in a jury? And I know I've been on a jury. I can speak from that experience. When you walk into a jury room, the first thing that the deputy asks you to do, the bailiff asks you to do,
right,
is he says, everybody take a vote right now.
Yep.
Because if you come up with everybody saying guilty, you're done. There's no reason to discuss anything.
Right.
Okay. The first vote, 7 of them said not guilty.
Right.
Now, come out. I've read two of the jurors have come out.
Yeah.
One of them was a father of a sheriff deputy.
That's right.
One of them was a cousin or sibling or something of somebody who worked in the courthouse.
That's right.
Both of them, upon listening to an excused juror,
mm-hmm.
and we'll get into him in just a second, listening to an excused juror, sat down and said, that's it, he's guilty and we're not voting anything else.
That's right.
Now.
And they wore everybody down, which is what happens right. a lot of times.
In a trial like this, now my trial, we were done in like 2 hours, mm-hmm. so it wasn't this excruciating. At what point is a person's breaking point? Those jury rooms aren't that big.
Right.
When you're secluded from your family, when you're taken from a jury room to a hotel, because this is a high-profile case, they were all staying in hotels. When you're taken from a jury room to a hotel and you're advised not to leave that room because they're serving you dinner and they don't want you to discuss it with anybody, and you're taken back to the courthouse to sit in that jury room, what is your breaking point?
Yeah.
What is your breaking point to say, oh, well, he's guilty?
That's right.
And the juror that was excused that night, the one, and there's a lot on him.
Right.
I can't remember his name offhand.
Yeah.
But he was very, he's been very talked about, and he's been very pushy in all of this.
Right.
To saying he was excused because of a car crash of his daughter.
Right.
His daughter was in the middle of nowhere, got in a car crash, she had no signal, and the police showed up.
Yeah.
Now, really, to be honest, and he was one of them guys that he was hardcore. He didn't. There, I don't know if he did it, but there's not enough evidence. You can't make me say he did it based right. on the evidence they presented. All of a sudden, he's excused.
And this is out there on YouTube.
Because of a car accident.
Because
right.
there's this guy that dug this up, and he's got this. He's a conspiracy theorist, admittedly. But, yeah, he believes that this girl's accident was no accident. Plus, I think it was like a simple rear ending. It was one of these things where nobody was going to die. But it was going to be serious enough to get him out of there.
It put her in the hospital.
Okay, it did put her in the hospital.
He had to go check on her. He had to go be responsible.
Okay.
Richard Mahler is the guy's name.
Okay.
So, what I'm seeing.
Okay.
Anyways.
Yeah, look this up, people, because this is another interesting angle. I mean, if you believe in the deep, deep, deep conspiracy, that's way down the rabbit hole. But that's a thing of, because the clear implication is law enforcement, with their eyes and ears inside the jury, knew that this guy had to go if they were going to get the prosecution of Stephen Avery to be successful. And he was disposed of in that way.
And there were
a lot to believe.
There were, and the other thing is, and I can see this because I'm going to tell you what, I'm a bit of a coward.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And anybody who knows me can tell you that. If that were me,
mm-hmm.
and this sheriff deputy's dad is telling me, oh, he's guilty, what are they going to do to me?
Yeah.
They framed this guy for 18 years and sent him away.
Yeah.
They're looking to frame him now. If I don't vote guilty, what are they going to do to me?
There's a lot of intimidation going on.
There was also another girl who came out,
mm-hmm.
another juror, saying they would hope mm-hmm. that the appellate court saw that they voted him guilty but not mutilation of the body.
Yeah.
And give him another trial.
Yeah, yeah. That it was almost like a dog whistle here of like, hey, you shouldn't take our conviction too seriously. Which, again, that's a naive thing on their part, because an appellate court is not going to read anything into that.
Right. Because, and that's another thing that blows my mind.
Allegations of vote trading in there. We'll get him on this, but not on
right,
this.
Because they're saying that, okay, well, he murdered her, but that body wasn't mutilated there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another thing that gets me on why Stephen Avery would do it. If they said that body wasn't mutilated there,
right,
and there's no evidence of DNA, why would he put it in his own burn pit?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, and in looking at this, there's just a lot that we don't know, and this is where I come back to as far as a bottom line for the case here. When I look at it again, not that I'm necessarily deferring because I don't know that these people know anything more than I do, notwithstanding their degrees, but like a Dr. Drew or somebody. I mean, I'm separating him from Nancy Grace. To me, he's got a level of seriousness that she doesn't have because she's just like a screechy kind of, you know, burn everybody kind of mentality. But for Dr. Drew to say, as he said on his show, I think this guy's a monster, I think he did it, whatever, like, there's things that people see in this guy that we obviously don't see in the documentary because it's somewhat shaded towards his family and their point of view. But it's a thing where I just wonder. And then, like, the thing when Jody, the ex-fiancé, comes out and says, he beat me, he is a monster, he whatever, that's what makes me wonder, too. There are people that have a fuller picture of the guy, it seems like, than you and I do, and right. I don't know what we don't know about him.
Right.
So, I mean... Well, we're both 100% towards him and his nephew need a new trial, and I think that's where everybody needs to come out.
And I really think he needs to be seen by a psychiatrist.
That would help
because
a lot.
My thought is if he did it, it's a personality disorder, and maybe he doesn't know he did it.
Well, and that's the other thing here, too. Making a murderer, they chose as a title the greatest possible one they ever could have gone for because they're using it in the sense of making a murderer the police, you know, or the sheriff's department, rather. We keep saying police, but it's the sheriff's department. They framed him, they whatever, they made him appear guilty. The other obvious application of the term making a murderer is he went away for 18 years. You know what happens to people convicted of sex crimes in jail? It ain't pretty. What happened to him in 18 years that turned him into the monster that came out on the outside if you believe that he did it?
Right.
So the system made him a murderer on the inside. If he did it, that's the other very clear implication. So making a murderer applies one way or another, either by framing him or the system converting him into being something that he wasn't when he went in there. I lean 60-40. I mean, this is my final bottom line on this. I go back and forth. I'm like a weather vane on this as I continue to hear new stuff. I'm saying 60-40, I think he did it. What's your sense?
I'm going to go 50-50.
Okay.
Because... Like I said, I think if he did do it, it was some sort of psychiatric disorder. He doesn't know.
That's very possible. Yeah, because, I mean, I think he'd have done a better job of, you know, covering his tracks if it was that. I've even seen one theory that he may be so sick that it's a thing of that. Because, again, he did kind of struggle a little bit on the outside. Whether or not he had his issues with Jody, he was fairly on the record that it was a tough reacclimation to life on the outside. And that maybe part of that sickness is, you know what, let me go back inside.
Right.
You know?
Because it's what he's used to.
Yeah, it's what I'm used to. I'm used to going back in. I get up every day. I fight for my freedom. That's what I'm used to. That's the routine. And that deep down, that's how he likes it. I don't know. I mean, that's we're talking about degrees of sickness that I don't even really claim to understand. But, I mean,
right. As
recently as about 2 weeks ago, I think I said on the show in the context of another conversation where it came up briefly, I think I said I thought I was 51-49 innocent. At one point, I was up to, I'd say, 67-33 guilty. Now I'm back to 60-40.
Right.
I mean, it depends on what keeps coming out here. But
right. It's
a fascinating case. We tried to cover it from all angles. In the span of 100 minutes, I feel like we did it. Is there anything you feel like we didn't?
I feel like we did great. It's
okay.
A lot to cover.
Yeah.
I think we could go on for this for hours, but I think we've put enough out there for people to ponder on and think about.
We probably could. And in terms of this being linear, in terms of the time frame and everything else like that, I'm going to plead guilty to the fact that, you know, there was jumping around, there was whatever. This is a hell of a challenge to try to tie together. I can just say we did the best we could on this to try to hopefully make it something that you all can follow through and chew over and to make this just, you know, put this into the bloodstream. There's a big debate that's going on right now. Happy to be able to add our voices to it. So, Anthony, I know this was a show that you very much enjoyed watching. Thanks very
good.
Much.
Yep, absolutely.
I enjoyed talking about it with you. Thank you so much, yep. Buddy. All right, and thank you, everybody, for tuning in to FDH Lounge mini episode number 677.
we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, All Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.